in that tablet. And then Imam is just reciting that hadith in front of Jabir and asking him that whatever I'm reciting is the same one. You know, like look at the beautiful, like Imam is matching that you have seen yourself. I'm in this era, in this time, and I'm Baqirul Uloom, and I want to know that ilm and wisdom which Allah Ta'ala has given to my mother as a gift. And the story is so long, I can't mention all the story over here, but it shows the source of the ilm is from Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha too.
Divine,
you know,
knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore, you know, Aima alayhi salam, they would say, inna indana al-jami'ah. We have one book, which is jami'ah. You know, which
comprehensive?
Yeah, jami'ah is like zat jami'ah, a comprehensive book, which is exclusively for Aima alayhi salam. And then Imam says, inna indana al-jafra. We have one more knowledge and ilm, which is jafra. And then they say, inna indana la mushafu Fatima. Like, we have mushafu Fatima. This is the ilm of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. And then what Imam said? Imam said, this mushafu Fatima, you know, it has everything which can make us needless, you know, from people, and which make people needy towards us because of that knowledge and ilm. So we know that imamat and ilm is, you know, always together. Yeah, cannot be apart at all. But the source of ilm of Aima alayhi salam is mostly, we know about Madinatul Ilm, Babul Ilm, but we don't mention about Ummul Ulum, Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha. So I really want to mention about tablet hadith. Mm-hmm. If you know Arabic, you could just type hadithul lawh. You will enjoy, number one. Number two is about this hadith which talks about mushaf. Mushaf means that book in which Bibi Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, she would have conversation with Jibreel after the demise of Rasulullah.
So, you know, she like was the
constantly,
scientific source.
Exactly. Constantly for 95 or 75 days, Our Lady, our soul mother, she was connected to that divine source. Mm-hmm. So all those knowledges has been spread among her children. And
right.
Then Imam Baqir, he has become Baqirul Uloom min al-awwaleen wal-akhirin. Ya'ulum al-nabiyyin wal-wasriyyin. So he's reflecting, he's just manifesting all the sciences of all the Anbiya alayhi salam from beginning till end. So that much powerful, the heart, the qalb, and the, you know, the beautiful
knowledge,
we can say knowledge, yeah, our Imam he had.
Thank you so much, Dr. Radia. This brings us to the end of the first part of this show, Light Upon Light, a special program on the occasion of the birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. But we're not finished yet. Inshallah, we're going to go for a very short break, and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Imam Baqir, the fifth Shia leader and the son of Imam Sajjad, was born in Holy Medina in 57 after Hijra. Imam Baqir had a prominent lineage on both paternal and maternal ends, and his mother was Fatima, the daughter of Imam Hasan al-Mujtaba. Imam Muhammad Baqir was named after his grandfather, the Holy Prophet of Islam, and due to his great scientific activities and achievements, he was titled Baqir al-Ulum, meaning the opener of knowledge. Imam Baqir was one of the survivors of Karbala tragedy, as he was 4 years old in the time of the event. Along with his father and the rest of the pure household, Imam Baqir experienced the hard times of captivity in Kufa and Damascus. In this regard, the Holy Imam is quoted saying that the martyrdom of the 3-year-old daughter of Imam Hussein saved the lives of other captives, as the enemy had made up its mind to bury all captives under the rubble of the destructive building where they were settled. The Umayyad rulers were mostly preoccupied with fighting over power, and this gave enough space to Imam Baqir to begin a widespread scientific and religious movement, which revived the traditions of the Holy Prophet and educated many students. Contemporary to the life of Imam Baqir, the genuine Islamic thoughts were under attack by torrents of heretic thoughts, which were mostly originated from the forged narrations and the misinterpretations of Islamic teachings by the Umayyad underlings. Therefore, Imam Baqir focused his works on educating talented students and holding religious and scientific debates with non-Shia personalities. Determinism, the refutation of faith for minor sins, the belief that God has a body and can be seen, and the belief that sins have no consequences were only some of the widespread heretic thoughts at the time of Imam Baqir. Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari was the only companion of the Holy Prophet who lived long enough to meet Imam Muhammad Baqir. In fact, the Holy Prophet had informed Jabir that one day he will meet of the Prophet's descendants, who is called Imam Muhammad Baqir. Finally, this prophecy was realized, and Jabir met Imam Baqir and testified for his imamate. Despite the expansive works done to destroy the legacies of Imam Baqir, the narrations and teachings of the fifth Shia leader remain as one of the most sparkling beacons that shed light on the path of Shia Muslims in the fields of Islamic jurisprudence, interpretation of the Quran, and explanation of Islamic beliefs. Most of the acts of worship and the Islamic rituals we practice today are referenced to the juridical viewpoints of Imam Baqir, which have escaped the sight of enemies of Shia Islam in history. Finally, Imam Baqir was poisoned at the orders of the Umayyad rulers on 114 after Hijra, and he was buried in the cemetery of Baqi in Medina.
Welcome back, dear believers. The program Light Upon Light is a special episode on the occasion of the birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, our fifth Imam. The Imam, the most outstanding feature of whom was being Baqir al-Ulum, the one who is the dissector of knowledge. We have the presence of Dr. Radia Batul Najafi. We talked in the first part about the scientific aspect of the life of Imam Baqir and how he himself has focused that our source of knowledge is Mus'haf Fatima. So somehow the mother is like a well that all of the imams are taking knowledge out of, and she is the one who is actually enlightening all of her children with her knowledge.
Absolutely.
And that's amazing. So let's talk a little bit now about the social life of the imam. His role as a teacher, because he had many, many students. Can we name some of his most famous students, the discourses that he had with the scholars, and the role that he played in this specific area of his life?
This is so common among us that the University of Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam, we talk mostly about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that he established the university and he has trained so many students. Like, this is so, again, very, very common among us that in one session there would be more than 4,000 students in the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. But the root, source of the universities of Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam was Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. We sometimes, unfortunately, we don't mention that much about Imam Baqir as a founder of the universities and the maqatib of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the way he has protected about the Shiaism, the true and the essence of Shia thoughts and doctrine. So we know that the most of the very outstanding companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they were the companion of the student of Imam Baqir alayhi salam too. Mm-hmm. And they have started their journey
from
Imam Baqir alayhi salam. And the same thing, whatever we know in detail about the students and about the topics, about the subjects which Imam used to cover. Unfortunately, Fatima Jan, I wish we could just spread out this knowledge, this wisdom, this beautiful information that, when ilm and wisdom and sciences were in the hand of A'imma alayhi salam, like Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq, we never ever split the ilm between dunya and deen, worldly knowledge, or secular knowledge. There was no knowledge. Knowledge means nur, light. Knowledge means whatever human being can take benefit of it, or whatever skills I will learn and I can be in the service of the people, and the creation of Allah. That is knowledge. That is nur. Mm-hmm. So nowadays, unfortunately, we can say, this is Islamic school and this is non-Islamic.
Yeah.
This is, even the period, you say, this is Islamiyat period. This is wrong. This is totally wrong. The way I cannot separate my soul and my body, this is always together. The same way we have whatever is good for human being is is so much holy and very, very sacred in the eyes of Allah Ta'ala. We call it ilm. You know, definitely ulum has different kind of levels, but still all the ulum which is beneficial has been taught in the University of Imam Baqirul Ulum. Yeah, so we have, what you know better than me, how many subjects were there, and Imam used to train them. Like now, nowadays we have specialization, you know, like part, like we say, this is department of history, and this is about ideology, aqaid, and this is about, you know, tafsir, the sciences of Quran, and this is about, for example, chemistry, you know. So the same way, this was so amazing. Imam would train his students in different, like Imam knows, you know, that how much talent this student has. So Imam would say, oh, this is your part, and you know, this is your duty. And whenever he would have debates, munazara, and so many beautiful ways to propagate his knowledge, he would send, most of the time, he would say, no, I will not come to debate. I will send my student, you know. And if you have any question about this topic, this would be the best, you know, because he is expert in this science. So this is so amazing because, you know, we, after the Ayyim Alim Islam, we would not have it, this style. Right? Mm. Like, if you remember, maybe 200 years back, there was only one maktab. You know, like we are just watching in the movies or in history, you know, that there was only one maktab and people would go there and, you know, one
learn
place.
Very basic things,
nothing was in detail. Mm-hmm. But in the time of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, especially Imam Baqir alayhi salam, everything was in detail. Like very well and modernly organized. Maybe still we are backward compared to the way they have established about how to teach, you know, the beautiful techniques of teaching, the beautiful way of distributing the knowledge, you know, according to that time, that was, you know, so much beyond the time, definitely.
All right, thank you so much, Dr. Najafi. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Light Upon Light, a special program on the occasion of the birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. We hope that, inshallah, like Dr. Radia said, we will be able to gain knowledge in such a way that we can benefit humanity by learning it, inshallah. Thank you all once again for joining us. Until another episode of Light Upon Light, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. A man-made winter fairyland, that's what visitors may refer to, an ice and snow festival in the Chinese city of Harbin. Three giant ox sculptures are on display in this year's edition of the event as China is celebrating the Year of Ox. The park features hundreds of ice sculptures and castles. The Chili Festival traditionally draws millions of people from around the globe, but it's now receiving a limited number of visitors due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Australia is offering an environmentally friendly kayak tour in Sydney's harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves, and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month, about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing, and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally every year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish. in the ocean.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading under bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to 5 giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
A German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here three or four times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around North America to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including three previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at that time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We have all heard the famous saying, survival of the fittest, right? And when we talk about survival of the fittest, it is usually associated with being ruthless, with being selfish, with, you know, minding your own business, not getting distracted by life's drama, even if it means, you know, helping other people out, taking time out of your day, sacrificing your energy and your time and your work or whatever to help improve other people's lives and situations. Survival of the fittest means that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world and this and that. But even Darwin himself believed, who by the way studied human evolution, believed that mankind is not naturally or biologically competitive or that self-centered as we might think he is. As a matter of fact, Darwin believed that we are profoundly social beings, that caring and being kind is what's innate and biological about us. We are such social beings that I was reading an article a while back talking about a hospital where their nursery had a section basically that would take care of abandoned newborns, and they would take in volunteers to come and just hold these newborns and have skin-to-skin contact with them during the first few weeks of those newborns, those infants' development, because otherwise there was the fear of the infants dying if they could not have that human contact. That's how social we are. Now, what does that have to do with kindness? How about we listen to a short story on this matter and continue our discussion after that? Stay with us.
The hotel clerk who helped the couple. We have an interesting story for today. On a stormy night many years ago, an elderly man and his wife entered the lobby of a small hotel in Philadelphia, USA. The couple approached the front desk, hoping to get some shelter for the night. "Could you possibly give us a room here?" the husband asked. The clerk, a friendly man, looked at the couple and explained that there were three conventions in town. "All of our rooms are taken," the clerk said. "But I can't send a nice couple like you out into the rain at night. Would you perhaps be willing to sleep in my room?" When the couple declined, the young man pressed on. "Don't worry about me. I'll make out just fine," the clerk told them. So the couple agreed. As he paid his bill the next morning, the elderly man said to the clerk, "You are the kind of manager who should be the boss of the best hotel. Maybe someday I'll build one for you." The clerk looked at them and smiled. 2 years passed. The clerk had almost forgotten the incident when he received a letter from the old man. He recalled that stormy night and enclosed a round trip ticket to New York, asking the young man to pay them a visit. The old man met him in New York and led him to the corner of 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Then he pointed to a great new building there, with watchtowers thrusting up to the sky. "That," said the old man, "is the hotel I have just built for you to manage." "You must be joking," the young man said. "I can assure you I'm not," said the old man. The old man's name was William Waldorf Astor, and that structure was the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The young clerk who became its first manager was George C. Bolt. This young clerk never foresaw the turn of events that would lead him to become the top man of one of the world's most glamorous hotels. ¶¶
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Now, obviously, we cannot be hope to be kind unless we socialize with other human beings. I can't lock myself up in a room and then describe myself as a kind person unless I have manifested that kindness in my interactions with other creatures, whether it's humans, whether it's plants, animals, environment, nature. So in order to express that kindness, I need to associate myself with other people and creatures, and most importantly, strengthen that quality and attribute within myself. It is very easy, it is very simple, it is even common sense to be kind toward those who are kind to me. But the Quran and Islam takes it a step further, because obviously Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had been sent to complete the best of morals and ethics, right? So kindness is a moral act. Being kind toward those who aren't kind to me is the best of ethics and morals. And that is what the Quran teaches us. Idfa billati hiya ahsan. If someone is unkind to me, if someone insults me, if someone hurts my ego and my pride, an act of kindness from me toward them will bring down the flame of rage, anger, and animosity between us and bring the hearts closer. I was reading through, I think, Psychology Today, and scientific researchers have shown that spending and devoting our resources on other people rather than mostly on ourselves brings about lasting well-being. And that's very interesting, because as the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam has said, only that which you spend on others will last for you. And my mind was blown. This is a literal hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And because they spoke the truth, after a while, science and research basically just come to the conclusion, the same conclusion and the same idea that they presented us with 1400 years ago. And aside from the fact that, well, they were infallible and whatever they said was wise, it is a natural common sense human thing. And to understand that truth is within us. We were equipped with it. We were created with it. So obviously it would make sense. But to spend our energy and resources on other people brings us a greater sense of fulfillment and achievement rather than just spending it on ourselves. And that is the key point that will help with our growth and self-betterment. If I spend all my energy and focus on myself, again, I cannot claim to have any sort of moral or ethical virtues and merits within me because, well, I didn't do anything special. But once I am able to transcend and go beyond myself, step beyond my own nafs, my own wantings and yearnings and desires, and spend my energy on other people, their accomplishments. Now, I'm not saying neglect myself entirely, because as cliche as this may sound, it is true. You can't pour from an empty cup. We have to spend a certain amount of our lives working on ourselves, bettering ourselves, strengthening our resources before we're able of even thinking about spending them on others. That's why self-refinement is so important in the teachings of Islam. That's why we're constantly taught to have muraqabah and have a sense of awareness and self-consciousness toward the things that we do, the thoughts that cross our minds. Are we kind enough to ourselves to be kind toward other people? And that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all, and you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, only on IRIB English Radio. And in this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book Children in Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. So I'm Hasnain, and we have our guest in our studio, Brother Miqdad. Salaamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners has a question that my child is slightly chubby, and because of that, he gets made fun of at football practice. So should I keep him or should I take him away from football? So this is the problem that usually, you know, chubby children get to face because of the bullies. So what do you suggest in this case that parents should do?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So a couple of points. First and foremost, it's important to find out if making fun of is done intentionally or is done with mean evilness in it.
Yeah.
Sometimes children, it depends on the age of the child, obviously, but after a certain age, children, when they make fun, they intentionally make fun to embarrass, to humiliate.
It's like body shaming.
Exactly, body shaming. And it's done in a bullying way, basically. Yeah. If that's the case, then I encourage the parents to speak to the coach, speak to the team that's responsible for managing this football practices, and to make sure this shouldn't happen, basically.
Yeah.
Sometimes, however, make fun of is actually just, it's just teasing a very naive,
innocent, like in a friendly manner.
In a friendly manner, basically. Yeah. And sometimes what happens is that parents feel bad, but actually the child never felt bad about it because he knew that my child, my friends were just joking around and it wasn't anything serious.
So it depends upon how the child is taking it.
Exactly. And it depends what kind of, not just how the child is taking it, but also what kind of made fun of was it? It was a really intentional, evil made fun of. Or was it actually a friendly way of just teasing, basically, which is not very damaging.
Yeah.
And sometimes parents feel really bad, but the child didn't feel bad at all. So those are for parents to just ignore, basically. The child will just overcome it and will just, it doesn't have any impact whatsoever, basically. So it needs to be clarified from the onset that what we're talking about. Secondly is that I would speak to the coach as well, again, this time to clarify what is it that the child is made fun of, basically.
Yeah.
Sometimes a child...
Like fat shaming, it might be.
Yes, but why? Is it because a child just doesn't look slim or doesn't look like all the other players?
Mm-hmm.
In which case, it's irrelevant to football. It'll happen anywhere, basically.
Yeah, anyway. Right? Like, it might also happen in school.
Exactly. But sometimes it's because of football, specifically. The child who mm-hmm. is a bit chubby can't play football properly.
Yeah.
Right? Just is not able to run as mm-hmm. fast as others. Yeah. Is not able to kick the ball as others.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then I would find out if it's really possible to, if the coach will be able to determine basically if it's really worth carrying on or not. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you realize that, and it's up to parents to be realistic again. That yeah. Sometimes you realize that children are just not able to do certain things, mm-hmm. right? And it's actually not healthy to push a child into something that mm-hmm. you know he's not able to do. Yeah. Right? Some children that are, because of their physical condition, are not able to play football. Yeah. That's fine. It's not the end of the world. It's not yeah. counted as a failure. I'll be good at other sports.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll just take a short break over here, and your audience stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break.
Wait! Stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience. We're talking about children getting bullied by their mates. So, Brother Mugdar, please carry on.
So, talk to the coach and find out if really the child is not able to play football. Mm-hmm. And if the coach has tried, basically. Obviously, mm-hmm. if it's a good coach, then he's tried to encourage, he's tried to teach, he's tried to bring about team spirit as well. Yeah. If all that has happened and there's no sense of progress mm-hmm. in the child.
You know, what happens sometimes is, you know, parents see in this way, their child is chubby and they send them for football, which even the child wants to go. You know, it can help him in losing some weight. It can help him, you know, getting active through sports, different sports. But yes. Over there, he finds some bullies.
Now, if it's really there's no progress in football, for example, uh-huh. right? There are other sports and there are other ways to lose mm. weight, or there's other ways a child can enjoy himself as well, uh-huh. right? Sports is also, a lot of it is related to fun and enjoyment. Mm. So if the parents realizes that my child can't do well in football mm. and maybe if I encourage him to do other sports,
yeah.
He'll become much greater, much mm-hmm. better, and actually achieve the same level of fun and happiness as mm-hmm. well as exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Then let's do that, basically. Let's mm-hmm. avoid football. It's not mm-hmm. necessary that we all have to do football.
Yeah.
Now, at times, what happens is that there is social pressure.
Right? Yeah, so, like, making, you know, getting, you know, made fun of can also put the child in mental stress.
Yes. But the point I was going to make is that sometimes there's social pressure in the sense that, let me put it, a peer pressure, right?
Yeah.
All my friends play football.
Mm-hmm.
It won't look nice if I don't play football.
Yeah.
And this is what encouraged me to play football.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why a child will say, no, I read and be adamant to play football because mm-hmm. he's under peer pressure.
Yeah.
Now, in this case,
he just doesn't want to be out of the frame.
Exactly. He doesn't want to be out of the social norms of everybody playing yeah. football. If that's the case, then obviously, again, it's something difficult to say. It depends on different circumstances. The parents mm-hmm. have to make the right decision over here and judge according to what is best in the interest of the child. However, one important aspect is to strengthen the confidence of the child.
Mm-hmm.
If a child feels confident, in the sense that he doesn't succumb to peer pressure,
yeah.
right? A child who believes and has enough self-respect, mm-hmm. in the sense that if other people all go to football, it's okay if I don't go. I still count myself important. Mm-hmm. I have my own self-respect. I have my own self-confidence. And I'm very...
Hey, he should take a decision with his own personal choice, not exactly. just because of the peer pressure.
And he's confident to tell it to his friend that you guys go play football. I'm happy not to come play football. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do something else. I'm going swimming, for example. I'm going martial arts, for example. Yeah. And this obviously comes through a good, strong Islamic child upbringing, where we're able to give children enough confidence, enough self-respect to be able to go against peer pressure. And this is actually, if you're able to do this, then hats off. This is an immense success.
That's amazing, because
in today's world, being a Muslim is a peer pressure. To be with the norm and with the society today, you have to act in a way that is against Islamic principles a lot of the times. And so we need to train our children that you need to be have enough self-confidence and self-respect to go against the norm and stand out to do the right thing, that which is best for you.
That's right. So let's take a short break over here. So dear audience, stay tuned. يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're talking about how to train our children, you know, to go against the social norms. So, Brother McDowell, please continue.
So, if we're able to talk to a child, explain to him that perhaps we need to be realistic, we can do other sports, or even sometimes without mentioning it to the child. He doesn't need to know. Again, depending on the child's age, depending on his understanding, depending on the different circumstances, encourage him to do other sports with his friends. Or with new friends, encourage, scope and widen the scope of exercise and activities that we have. Right, there's a lot of things that we can do out there, not just a standard football and volleyball. And you can do mountain climbing, you can do wall climbing, you can do canoeing, you can do martial arts. You can do so many different things out there. Right, some of them are more physical than others. Some of them require other skills that are not present in other sports. But it's important that we explore, right? And at times, children have a body restriction that doesn't allow them to do certain things. But if we're able to give them enough confidence and self-respect to understand that this is how my body is and has some limitations, but I have other skills and other abilities I can do.
So let me ask a question again, like reframing it. Like, you know, if a child is interested in some sort of sport, so, but over there he's made fun of just because being chubby. So what he can do over there, like be it any sports, you know, just people fat shame him or like body shaming. What can parents do over here?
If you mean that a child is adamant that he wants to play football, take our situation, he's adamant he wants to play football even though he's being bullied. He doesn't mind being bullied. He's happy to bear it and still carry on playing. I would suggest that we need to understand if really he's doing this because of peer pressure or not. Sometimes a child is happy to be bullied but still wants to go on because of peer pressure, because if he feels that if he leaves, he'll be counted as a failure, he'll be counted as a loser, that we made fun of you and therefore you left, basically.
No, he's playing football because he wants to play, but over there he's getting bullied.
Okay, so if it's the first situation where he's actually doing it because of peer pressure, then it goes back to parents dealing with the situation in a very mature way, encouraging the child to see that, no, don't worry about this. Your ability is greater than what you're seeing over here. And to convince the child in a way to take another sport or be able to adapt to the situation in a better way. Because it, in a continuous fashion, in the long term, to be continuously bullied and made fun of it can be dangerous for a child's mental health. However, if a child wants to carry on playing football despite the fact that they're bullied because they enjoy playing football, then it comes back to speaking to the coach and telling the coach that my child loves playing football, but this is happening on the pitch, is being bullied, is being made fun of. Is it possible for you to do something as a coach? And if it's
what about
coach,
parents teaching the child, you know, how to handle the bullies?
Yes, you can, but at the end of the day, usually bully happens when you're all alone and you're surrounded by other children. There's not much you can do externally. I mean, obviously internally, you can teach a child that you have to be strong inside you, But you don't want to teach a child to respond back or to
There might be some physical fight or something.
Yeah,
like
you don't want to get involved in all that kind of stuff. You can teach a child to ignore, a child to be strong within, basically. Mm-hmm. But this needs to be tackled at an authority level, basically, mm-hmm. where you need to speak to the coach, you need to speak mm-hmm. to the parents if necessary, to make sure these things do not happen. Mm-hmm. And usually it's tackled by creating a good team spirit, by creating a good bonding between the children.
Yeah, can it also be done by not reacting to the bullies?
Yeah, yes, ignoring bullying as well is a way to stop the bullying as well.
So thank you so much, Brother Mukhtar. That was a great discussion. And thank you so much, dear listeners, for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm your host, Saeed Purza. Straight to our top story. China has banned BBC World News from airing in the country. In a statement published at midnight Friday, China's National Radio and Television Administration criticized BBC reports for not being impartial and fair. China has defended its position, saying if the BBC chooses to be a rumor monger against China, it would have to bear the consequences. The news comes a week after UK media regulator Ofcom stripped Chinese state broadcaster CGTN of its British broadcast license. Ofcom accused the channel of breaching impartiality standards, an allegation China denies. For more on that, I'm joined by political analyst Carlos Martinez. Thank you for coming on. First off, your reaction to this recent flare-up of tensions between China and the UK.
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously the immediate context to this is that CGTN's broadcast license was revoked by Ofcom last week, purportedly on the basis that CGTN is a state broadcaster and answerable to the Chinese government. Well, regardless of what view anyone takes about that rule, we can all see that it's being applied in a selective and discriminatory way. Lots of state broadcasters have Ofcom licenses, including the BBC, national broadcasters from Japan, France, South Korea, and so on. And I think Press TV can probably sympathize with this predicament, having itself been subjected to the same type of discrimination. So really, in revoking the BBC's license, the Chinese authorities are responding in kind. And I think the public sentiment in China...
Right, and what do you think of the Chinese comment? They have accused the BBC of being, and I quote, a rumor monger against Beijing.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly accurate assessment. You know, BBC's coverage of China has been very biased, particularly in relation to Hong Kong and particularly in relation to Xinjiang. For example, the BBC recently featured a very long expose article about human rights abuses being perpetrated against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. But this expose was based almost exclusively on documents put together by some sources that have got basically no credibility whatsoever. First, there's Adrian Zenz, who's this sort of independent, far-right, anti-China crusader and a senior fellow at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, whose research methods are dubious, to say the least. And the other big source is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is a government think tank funded by the US State Department, funded by various arms manufacturers. So China's well within its rights to complain about the BBC's lack of objectivity and credibility.
Other than the BBC's coverage of Hong Kong, if we were to go back and to look at what has led to this flare-up in tensions between the two sides, anything else that you can think of? Because they said they were going to hit the reset button in terms of their relations, especially in the post-Brexit world. What did go wrong?
Yeah, pressing the reset button would be a correct and necessary thing to do. And in terms of the interests of the British people and in terms of humanity as a whole, in terms of the wider context of the new Cold War, would be a very sensible thing. Unfortunately, tensions between the UK and China have only ramped up over the last year or two. Obviously, in the last few weeks, we've had the dispatch of British Navy warships to the South China Sea in a clear statement of support for NATO and the US's China encirclement strategy, which is in itself an irresponsible and hostile act and a threat to peace. And I wonder what the British public's response would be if Chinese warships were to enter British waters. I suspect not very favorable. Meanwhile, a few months ago, you had Britain essentially taking orders from Mike Pompeo to remove Huawei from Britain's 5G infrastructure on spurious security grounds. And then, of course, we've got the interference in China's internal affairs by offering residency to Hong Kong's BNO passport holders, which is essentially making a statement in support of an anti-China separatist movement in Hong Kong, which itself, up till 1997, was a British colony run on more or less apartheid and highly anti-democratic lines. So, you know, we've got a state of tensions which is escalating. And it would be very wise for the British authorities to, as you put it, hit that reset button.
All right. Carlos Martinez, political analyst. Thanks for your input. Moving on now. At least 20 Israelis, including individuals from the weapons industry, are under investigation over illegal weapon sales to an unspecified Asian country. Israeli officials say the suspects developed, manufactured, tested, and sold suicide drones, also known as kamikaze drones, to the unnamed country. The news comes less than 2 weeks after the announcement of 3 sales of these kinds of weapons by the Israeli arms industry to unnamed Asian countries. Russia's UN delegation has clashed with Western ambassadors at a virtual meeting of the world body in New York.
Over the last 6 years, we've had 2 very important questions which Kiev still hasn't answered. How exactly do they intend to resolve the conflict? And how do they envisage the future special status of the Donbas region within Ukraine?
The United States reaffirms its unwavering commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. We will never recognize Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea.
Kiev's began its use of force shelling residential areas by its army, which continues to this day. How can the people of Donbas have any connection with Ukraine?
The people of Crimea voted to rejoin Russia in a referendum in 2014. Kiev ignored the decision and sent in troops, leading to clashes with Russian-backed separatists. So far, more than 14,000 people have been killed in the conflict. Russia says it's prepared to break off relations with the European Union if the bloc imposes any more sanctions on Moscow. The UK and EU have introduced targeted sanctions on Russia over Alexei Navalny, the country's leading far-right opposition figure. The EU is now considering additional measures over his recent jail sentence, a move lauded by Navalny's allies.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has made it very clear Russia will not tolerate the UK and EU interfering in its internal affairs. A week after Moscow expelled diplomats from Sweden, Poland and Germany, accusing them of attending a rally in support of opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Lavrov warned against any further provocations.
We do not want to isolate ourselves from the world, but we must be ready for this. If you want peace, prepare for war.
Navalny recently returned to Russia from Berlin, where he was recovering from a nerve gas poisoning. Accused of violating the terms of his parole in an embezzlement case dating back to 2014, he was arrested upon arrival and handed a 2.5-year jail sentence. And now he is in court again, facing charges of slandering a war veteran who appeared in a clip broadcast on Russia Today. It promoted constitutional reforms, which would extend President Vladimir Putin's rule. In a tweet, Navalny branded the war veteran and the others in the clip traitors, but he himself is now facing the same accusation. His allies are urging the EU